Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, September 1st. I'm Ray Graff. Once again, we return to the sky with renowned astronomer Bob Berman on today's show. Bob is one of the best known, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. You can find his work in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine, and the Old Farmer's Almanac. Give us a call now if you have a question for Bob, 800-348-2551. We're also joined today by NASA Solar System Ambassador His Excellency Charles Fulco here today. 800-348-2551 is our number. Astronomy Today on the show, and we will get started after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy on the program today, and we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman. Bob is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac and Astronomy Magazine. He is always a great guest and a popular one. I suggest you call early, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you can email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. And, we have another special guest in the studio today. NASA Solar System Ambassador Charles Fulco is here. And, it's been a while. You were on once before.
At least a couple months ago, right. Yes.
I remember your motorcade pulled up.
Yes.
And all your advanced security people were here. And so what have you been doing now in the intervening several months as NASA Solar System Ambassador?
Actually, I had a very productive summer. Was going to everywhere from Carbondale to Florida to D.C. and up to Stellafane in Vermont, promoting next year's total solar eclipse to be visible in the U.S.
Well, that's very exciting stuff.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, around here we won't see it as a total.
No, it'll be a partial up here in the 70s. So you don't want that kind of event. You want to go to where it really means something.
See, that's what Bob says, but I'm not driving to Ohio to see an eclipse.
Well, you wouldn't do well to drive there, actually, because it won't be total there.
Oh, really?
You have to get down to southern Illinois, Missouri, Tennessee,
Kentucky. Ah, okay.
But it's well worth the drive.
Okay. You pay for the gas?
I'll walk there if I have to.
Maybe you can get the UN to chip in for my gas bill?
I'll put you in my U-Haul.
Fair enough. The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman. What's happening? Something about a triangle in the sky you mentioned.
Yeah, it's great. And we like astronomy made easy because people don't want to bother with star charts and telescopes. And so many people buy those go-to telescopes. They think they're going to punch in Jupiter or Saturn, and the telescope's going to slew there, going to move there on its own. But there are setup steps, and people don't bother. So you want something easy and dramatic. And we've got it, probably the last really easy, dramatic thing of the year, and that is a striking, bright triangle that's visible as soon as darkness falls. Between 8:30 and 9 is the best time.
Mm-hmm.
You can look lowish, not super low, but lowish in the south. But if you don't know directions, that's fine, too, because there's only one triangle in the sky, and it's made up of three interesting objects.
And what are they?
And they are, on the left side, the brightest member of the triangle is Mars.
Okay.
Was at its closest to Earth in May, but it's still very close. And I'm going to come back to Mars in a moment and tell you why you should really be focusing on that. To the right of Mars is the star Antares, whose name means the rival of Mars. Because it's the same color. They're both orange. But it's a true star, the brightest star in Scorpius, the scorpion. And then the topmost member of the triangle is the planet Saturn.
Ah.
And that's where you really do want to point your telescope because it's the arguably most glorified, glorious object in the sky, deservedly so. It's just amazing through any small telescope. But if you don't have one, just keep your eye on Mars because every evening it moves. It shifts position, so it's going to stretch out the triangle like pizza cheese. It's just going to stretch it out, and what you're seeing is its actual orbital motion. It moves 15 miles per second. Earth goes 18 and a half miles per second. Mars is 15 miles a second, and you can actually see that speed night to night as the triangle changes shape due almost entirely to the Martian motion to the east or to the left, stretching it out. So for the next week, that triangle is going to be very cool with a telescope. Without a telescope, it's just astronomy made easy.
Okay, so if I had a telescope, and of course I do, and I don't know how to use the thing, but if I could find Saturn, Are the rings tilted as such that I may get a view?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. And you will find Saturn because it's the topmost star of the triangle. When is it that easy? Never.
You overestimate my competence, by the way. I've already tried.
You know, you'll find it. You'll find it.
Oh, really?
And the rings go through a cycle of getting edgewise and impossible to see and then tilting wide open, and they tilt about 26 degrees. They tilt more of an axis tilt than Earth even has, and it's wide open right now, so you can't get the rings any better than they are this year and next year.
Okay.
It's just absolutely beautiful. But the one trick is you need a steady night if you're going to use the telescope, because if the air is wiggly or blurry, and you can tell that's happening if the stars are twinkling. If to the naked eye the stars look twinkling, don't bother.
So cool night is better?
A hazy night is better.
Really?
Because around here, some moisture in the air tends to make the air more homogeneous in temperature. It doesn't cool as rapidly going up as it does when the air is dry. Hmm. And so the steadiest, best views are when it's when the stars are not really that good, when it's a little bit hazy. So if the stars are steady, that's when you point a telescope to the topmost star of that triangle, and you'll be glad you did.
Now, will I be able to see, if I have a good telescope, the hexagonal hurricane?
No, because that sits directly on top of Saturn at the North Pole, and you'd have to leave our sideways perspective and actually go above it the way two of our spacecraft, Cassini and before that Voyager 2, went north of the planet and was able to photograph it. So that's what you'd have to do to see that very bizarre hexagon, where each side of the hexagon is larger than our whole planet Earth.
And so have they discovered why it's there?
This idea is that they're standing waves, but nothing really satisfies the scale, really explains it. It's one thing to explain why, let's say, a snowflake could be hexagonal, but it's another thing to explain a structure where each side of the hexagon is larger than our planet. That's a different story. And winds blow right through it. Tornado-strength winds blow through this thing, and it's 60 miles high, and it rotates with the planet. So if Saturn has a tiny rocky core, this hexagon is rotating with the core of the planet, ignoring the winds that are blowing through it and remaining for decades. So, yes, it's still mysterious.
Our guest is Bob Berman, and we're also joined today by Charles Fulco. And the number to call is 800-348-2551. Well, let's go to the phones and take a call or two before the first break. And Jerry in Kingston. Jerry, you're on.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Could you confirm that there's also another triangle in the sky called the Summer Triangle that's visible overhead this time of year? I believe it's Vega, Altair, and Deneb.
Yes, exactly so, except friends don't let friends say Vega. Make sure you say Vega. It's one of the obnoxious ways that I don't make friends in the community. Because it comes from the Arabic word originally spelled W-E-G-A. In fact, in some of my beloved antique astronomy books that I have at home, it's actually written W-E-G-A. It was pronounced Wega, and was recently, that is 100 years ago or so, corrupted to Vega. But in the case of stars, you're almost always correct if you pronounce it the way it's written, because they've already been transliterated from the Arabic or the Greek or the Latin. So V-E-G-A should be pronounced Vega. But anyway, the caller is quite correct. There is the Great Summer Triangle. But that's so large that you'd have to really crane your neck, look high up, and then figure out, well, I wonder it's those three bright stars, whereas this is a lower, brighter, more compact, and more eye-catching triangle. However, the caller is quite right. The official Great Summer Triangle, made up the three stars that he cited correctly, is out there these nights, too.
Hmm. You know, I used to drive a Chevy Vega way back when.
I do have an additional question, if I can indulge.
Sure.
And it's a three-part question. And there's a lot of interesting news about astronomy, of course, in the last few days, and one of them having to do with this so-called Planet Nine that's been mathematically suggested to exist. My question would be, one, what percentage of stars in the Milky Way are binary stars, Two, is it possible the sun has a binary companion, a red dwarf, or something distant that we have not yet discovered? And three, what would the implications of the sun being a binary be for human life? And that's my question.
Okay, those are really great questions. The percentage of stars in the Milky Way was thought to be over 50%, slightly more than half. Then about 10 years ago, it was thought maybe it's a little less than half. And now it's back to most sources saying it's a little bit more than half. So that our sun being a single star, if indeed it is makes it a little bit in the minority, but not terribly odd. Can it have a companion? You know, some years ago, there were some ideas that it did, and that there was a periodicity, it was thought, to mass extinctions that could be explained by its companion that even had a name. Charles, you remember the name? Somebody even named it.
I'm trying to think, and I can't remember.
You remember. I'm talking about. It'll come to us during the show.
Was Nemesis the name?
Nemesis! Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Bless you.
It would have driven me crazy. Thank you so much, caller, for saying that. Yes, it was Nemesis. Because it was thought that mass extinctions happened in a regular form. So Nemesis, it was thought, could come close to the sun, perturb the Oort cloud of comets, and send some of them hurtling inward to these collisions. Now we know that the actual rate of collisions with Earth, in other words, 65 million years ago, then we had a mass extinction 251 million years ago, then about 300, then about 400, and they don't match any pattern.
Okay.
So now it's believed it doesn't exist. There's no evidence that the sun is a binary star. And if it did have a companion, even though we have tremendous surveys that are looking for nearby stars and we know a lot about a lot of them, there's nothing that suggests that there's a companion out there right now, which doesn't totally rule it out. But right now it's thought not.
Bob Berman is our guest today. We're also joined by Charles Foucault on this astronomy edition of Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for WMT comes from the Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sunday, 12 to 5, hydecollection.org. TJ's Taylor Rental and Party Plus, two locations, Route 9 in Hadley and Route 202 in South Hadley, providing tool and equipment rentals for homeowners and contractors. TJ'sTaylorRental.com. Saratoga Jewish Community Arts, presenting Nikki's Family, the story of Brydian Schindler, Sir Nicholas Winton, September 11th, 7 p.m. at Temple Sinai, saratogasinai.org. Curtis Lumber, featuring Anderson Windows, Therma-True Doors, Owens Corning Shingles, Valspar Paints, Cabot Stains, and more at 21 locations in New York and Northern Vermont, curtislumber.com. And Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's Astronomy Today. What an exciting day for you to be tuned in. Aren't you lucky? Bob Berman is here, also Charles Foucault, and you can join the fun, 800-348-2551. Or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. A couple of emails here real quick before we get back to the phones. This one's from Ann. How can you tell the difference between a satellite and a star?
Well, one's moving and the other isn't. The satellites really look like stars, and their brightness usually matches the stars. But the more salient question is, how do you tell a satellite from a plane? Because they're crossing the sky sometimes at about the same rate. And the main reason is that you'll see satellites only in the first 90 minutes after nightfall and 90 minutes before daybreak, generally. There won't be the port and starboard flashing lights that planes have. And satellites never cross the sky from east to west. They go in every direction except that. So that's another little clue.
Okay. And this one came in from Lee in somewhere. It occurs to me that the existence of dark matter and dark energy, in a way, validates the nearly ancient and much maligned concept of the ether and the ether wind. Am I just out of my mind? Well, Lee, I mean, that's they're not mutually exclusive. You could be out of your mind and make a good point. What do you think, Bob?
No, it has really nothing to do with it. The ether is a whole separate thing, and dark matter and dark energy are so different from each other. The problems they present and the evidence for each are entirely different animals. Just in a nutshell, dark matter is something that's exhibiting gravity, that the way our Milky Way galaxy and other galaxies rotate and the way galaxies act with each other shows there's about six times more gravity all around than we can account for with all the stars, nebulae, planets, black holes, and everything else we can think of. And so we simply call this unknown gravity-possessing but invisible substance dark matter. Well, dark energy is the opposite. That's something that's pushing the universe apart. That's also mysterious.
Well, explain for the listeners who weren't around when this was a hip concept, the concept of the ether.
The ether was to get around the idea that there's a vacuum. The Greeks abhorred the idea that there's such a thing as nothingness. They said, how can there be nothing? It contradicts. It's contradictory. Being is the opposite of nothingness. You can't be nothing. There can't be nothing. And it just doesn't exist. It's just like a silly idea. But it was thought that you had to have a substance for light to propagate through, just as you have to have air in order for sound
right.
to get from here to there. So it's thought there has to be an ether. It was a little odd that planets should be moving at high speed through this ether without producing any turbulence or waves or resistance. So there are a lot of ideas against it, and we were happy when about 100 years ago we were able to throw away the ether and realize that electromagnetic energy or light propagates perfectly well without there needing to be a substance that it goes through. So no more ether. And there's no reason to bring it back for dark matter or dark energy. Dark energy, again, is a repulsive quality to the universe that's making the galaxies all fly apart faster than they have a right to be flying apart, that they're exploding faster and faster as if they had rocket engines attached to them. And since we have no idea what's going on or what could do that, we hypothesize that the emptiness of space itself, in other words, the vacuum, has energy. And we even call it the vacuum energy sometimes.
Okay.
And that this has a pushing or repulsive force.
Okay.
And so that's what we call dark energy.
Well, Bob Berman is our guest today. We're also joined by His Excellency Charles Fulco, NASA Solar System Ambassador. Let's go back to the phones. David in North Adams. David, you're on.
Hello, gentlemen. Bob, I've spent about a decade trying to wrap my brain around string theory. And as I read Beyond Biocentrism, as startling as the concept of biocentrism is, it really seems to me to be getting more to the heart of explaining things in a much simpler way. So I'm intrigued by your latest book.
Well, thank you.
My question is, and this may be a dumb question, but I understand how light resolves from a probability wave into an actual measurable particle when it's observed from the double slit experiment. But are the implications of that, say if I walked out of my kitchen, would my refrigerator resolve into probability waves? Or would the monitoring systems in it, in a sense, be observing it?
Well, I don't know if I'll completely answer your question, but it's now thought that each subatomic particle in your refrigerator, yes, only exists probabilistically until an observer looks at it. Now, once you go there and grab the handle and reach for the milk in the fridge, in all probability, and this is all mathematical, there are so many atoms that make up each container of milk or make up your refrigerator that they are most likely to collapse. They'll always form a likelihood of collapsing in a certain place. A less likely place has its own probability. A still less likely place has its own smaller probability. And that's for each subatomic particle. So there's so many that overwhelmingly the likelihood is that the refrigerator and all the things in it will reappear where you remember them to be.
Oh, good.
But physics tells us that it's possible. This is what's amazing, that it's not impossible. It's possible that probably it would take the lifetime of the planet or more before this actually happens. You'll go into the kitchen and there won't be the refrigerator there anymore, to use your example, because it's rematerialized in the White House or some other place.
Or just Kate Upton holding a drink will be there or something.
So the fact that physics now says that this is possible, that's the amazing thing. That it's no longer.
That is mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is, man.
It is.
Hey, David, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go over to Eric in Albany. Eric, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hello. I had a question about, I just bought a laser for my, a telescope for my daughter. I had a question about any places in Albany where I could get it culminated. It's a Newtonian reflecting telescope. Also, any good places that you know of where I could observe Saturn, the best places
around. Well, you know, since you're in Albany, and my friend Chuck Wagon here, the NASA...
That's His Excellency, Charles Fulco, not Chuck Wagon, sir.
That's Mr. Wagon to you.
Lives not too far from here. Chuck, you want to answer that?
Sure. Actually, I live in Otis, Massachusetts, a far suburb of Albany.
Yeah.
That's about an hour away. And I have a nice place... by a lake, so I don't really have to go anywhere too far away to see a beautiful southern sky, you know, Milky Way.
So you really can't help it anyway.
No, I'm trying to think.
Give him your address. Let him come and set up.
When did I lose control of the program?
I would say northern Connecticut is known for its dark sky because the Rockland Astronomy Club has their annual dark sky convention there every year, and Pennsylvania, also Cherry Hill.
And go 15 miles out of town.
And what about
into
getting
the mountains, Eric? You'll
you
be fine.
Light pollution in Albany, though. You have
I mean,
to
you
get
go 15,
out of town.
You go over the Helderbergs, you're good to go. I mean, come on.
That's right. And what about collimating? He asked about collimating it.
That's
yes,
is there
anywhere around that I could have someone do it for me, or difficult to learn?
I do all my collimating in New York, by the way, where I'm originally from. I'm a relative transplant to the Berkshires, so I still do all my major things.
Can you do it? Can you do it for him, for this fella?
If we could get together, sure.
Well, why don't we? We'll leave the contact information for Bob is on our website.
Sure.
You can email Bob, and Bob can get in touch with the ambassador. For you.
Find more dark sky locations.
Okay.
Too.
Well, Eric, hey, good luck, man. I would just say, you know, having watched my share of comets and everything else, you know, just get over the hill and get away from the light, and it won't be that tough. Really, not too bad.
I was thinking Mount Misery. That's where I went for the Perseid meteor shower, and that was pretty good. So it's pretty dark up there.
Yeah,
on the border of Mass and New York.
But, Mount Misery. Okay. Yes, that's where I'm going. All right, Eric, thanks a lot. We appreciate it. Over to Daniel in Great Barrington. Daniel, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask you about the Bermuda Triangle, the phenomenon I've heard about, that area where planes and ships disappeared.
Well, the only comment that I would make is something that I saw a special on TV. Obviously, it's out of the field of astronomy.
It's really not astronomy.
However, an analysis showed that particular area, if you took that same area of the Bermuda Triangle and put it over Alaska or some parts of the American West, there are more missing planes and downed planes in other places with equal area in other parts of the world, Alaska being one of them, than in that so-called Bermuda Triangle, so that it's not a particularly rife area for things to disappear.
You know, I heard about magnetic fields and things like that.
Well, even if that were true, and there are magnetic anomalies, as a pilot myself and an airplane owner until 2 days ago,
yeah.
I just sold my plane
oh,
two
congrats.
Days ago after 22 yeah. years.
Gonna get a blimp?
I can tell you that if you rely only on your magnetic compass to keep you turned the right way and keep what we say the dirty side down of the plane, you're not flying very well. So
okay.
So even if there were a magnetic anomaly, it shouldn't cause you any grief.
All right.
Really.
Well, Daniel, we appreciate that call very much. The number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Also, Charles Fulco today on an astronomy edition of Vox Pop. And let's go to Ron in Sloanesville. Ron.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with something a lot closer to the Earth's surface. Whenever I go visit Long Island, I always take the Frog's Neck Bridge, and I notice when you get about midway over, you know, like the peak of the arc, and you look over towards Manhattan, you get a fairly unobstructed view of at least the tops of the skyscrapers, and I've noticed that the ones on the southernmost side seem to be skewed toward the south, and the ones on the northernmost side seem to be skewed towards the north. And I was wondering, am I seeing a very good observation of the curvature of the Earth?
In other words, by skewed, you mean that the buildings don't appear vertical to you, that they're actually leaning in these two different directions?
Yeah, no, like they're not all parallel to each other. The ones south seem to be pointing in that direction.
That's something you'd get on a very wide-angle camera lens. You'd get that kind of effect, but the eye would not see anything like that. However, you really can see the curve of Earth, not quite that dramatically, but if you go to the ocean, I happen to have a facto in my head you might enjoy, and if you're sitting on a beach chair right on the water's edge, the horizon is at that point a little closer than 2 miles away, so that sharp edge that you see at the ocean's edge, that's not the ocean going on and on and on, but it's actually the curve of the horizon.
Oh,
anything small object over that is over the horizon. And here's something else. This is a favorite thing I love. If you're in a large lake, largish lake, and there still may be a little bit of swimming left to the summer for some
right
of us.
Right, you are. Sure.
Sink your head in like a crocodile. You know, in other words, hold your breath, let your mouth get under the water, and let your eyes only be an inch or two above the water, and look at the distant shore, and you'll see the distant shoreline vanish over the horizon. So in other words, if you can get your eye just an inch or two above the water, you'll actually see the curvature of the lake as part of Earth's curve.
Fascinating. You've done this.
I've done this.
I believe it. Ron, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. So, wait, the horizon is only 2 miles away? Are you sure about that?
Yes, quite so. Because the formula for it is your height, the square root of your height in feet. Now, if you're sitting on a beach chair, you're 4 feet above the water.
Right.
The square root of that is 2, times 1.23. It's so easy because it's 1, 2, 3. Times 1.23 gives you the distance to the horizon in miles. So,
okay.
Again, square root of your height in feet.
Okay.
Times 1.23 is the horizon's distance in miles.
The height of where your eyes are.
Yes, height of where your eyes are. So, in other words, if you're in a 10-story building, in other words, 100 feet up.
Yeah.
Now the square root of 100 is 10.
Right.
Times 1.23 would be 12 miles.
Uh-huh.
So from a 10-story vantage point, a house by the ocean, let's say, 10 stories up, the horizon is 12.3 miles away.
Interesting. Well, on the beach, when we're up in Maine, we can see Boone Lighthouse at 6 miles out. We can.
But you don't see the bottom of it. Use your binoculars next time.
Oh, you're very smart. That's why you're the astronomer on the show. let's go to Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Hi. Before I ask my question, as far as collimating a telescope, all you have to do is Google collimating a Newtonian telescope, and it will give you, you find a site that will tell you exactly how to do it. It's not very complicated. You just have to make sure that everything is centered. The secondary mirror is centered in the eyepiece, and the mirror is centered on the secondary mirror, and that can be done by yourself as long as you follow some relatively simple directions, or you can go to one of the books like the Amateur Telescope Making Book 1 from Scientific American, which is out of print probably, but there's still lots of copies of it around. It's something that if you own a telescope, you need to do it almost every time you set it up.
Okay.
So it's
you're
a good
quite
thing to
right
learn.
Now. And of course, Charles and I have done this many times. I am director of the observatory. I have to do it all the time. But there are some people who just can't do it, or don't believe they can do it, or don't want to do it, and so they're asking others for help. So I wonder if the caller, would you do it for that other caller? Would you if they
we
contacted
can't do
you?
That.
We can't do that.
No, we're not doing.
See, I don't know what the rules are.
It's a dating show. Put it out.
I would do it in I'm up here in Washington County, but it's something that I learned in, I guess, sixth grade.
Yeah.
question is. Just recently, they have discovered a planet, and I want to say Alpha Centauri, but I think it was Proxima Centauri.
Ah, right you are. We were discussing that prior to the show. Bob's well-versed on this. His old friend, Proxima.
Yeah, that they feel it's in that Goldilocks zone. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure, we have a couple of minutes before the break, so this is a good way to
Proxima is the closest star, 4.2 light years, even closer than the beautiful naked eye star Alpha Centauri, which just in binoculars you can see it as a double. Boy, is that a double star. Beautiful double star. You know, every 50 actually, it's 80 years. They go around, the two companions go around each other, 80 years on the nose.
Yeah.
But those two are 4.3 light years away. A little closer, 1/10 of a light year closer, is this little red spectroclass M star that's Proxima. And so it's beloved to all of us as the very closest star to Earth. Yes, just found was that it's got a little tiny planet very close to it, only about 1/20th the distance that Earth is to the sun.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that close.
6 million miles.
And that's how
like that.
That's how close you have to be to a class M5 star, because it's such a weak, dim star, in order to be in the Goldilocks zone where you could possibly have liquid water. Now, that said, it's in one way it's exciting, because we know now that there's a planet that could be Earth.
Rocky and Earth-like.
Yes, and that's the closest star to us. On the other hand, now there's unending evidence that probably every star in the Milky Way galaxy has planets, and probably one or more of those planets is in a Goldilocks zone. So it's almost like, how many more do we have to find?
Yeah, but this one is the closest,
yes, okay,
man.
So that's
this is the closest.
The thing, it's so close to us that it is conceivable in some future date that we might be able to communicate with. Yeah,
but the thing is,
one way or the other.
As I understand it, this is tidally locked, right? So it's so one side is facing all the time.
Well,
similar to our moon.
Yes, probably. But remember, we thought Mercury was tidally locked because it's so close to our sun, and our sun is far more massive than Proxima Centauri. And yet it turns out that Mercury has a 59-day rotation as compared revolution compared to its instead of its 88-day orbit. In other words, it rotates in 59 days. It orbits in 88 days. They don't match, even though logically we thought they should.
Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a break here on the astronomy program. Also, Ambassador Charles Fulco joins us. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We'll be right back.
Support for WMT comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. The Arthur Zankel Music Center at Skidmore College, a cultural resource for the upstate region, providing a teaching, recording, and performance venue with rental options available. Skidmore.edu/ZANKEL. Careers in Transition LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham providing individual career guidance, testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume, and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Huntsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Huntsberger.artistwebsites.com. And College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts. For over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing, full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, joined today by Bob Berman and Charles Fulco. It's the Astronomy Show. Before we get back to the phones, gentlemen, this one came in via email from Kermit, who says, and actually this is a topic we also discussed in the Green Room, would you be kind enough to ask Professor Berman his reaction to the Russian SETI claim of having received a signal, while the U.S. SETI community remains skeptical? His analysis would be appreciated.
Well, I only recently looked at that, but from what I can see superficially, it's being rejected because we think that it's a terrestrial signal. It's not an extraterrestrial signal. And Seth Shostak, who runs SETI, who I'm in touch with periodically, when last I spoke to him, said, you know, they're still looking. There's no there's been lots of false alarms, and so that keeps us saying, okay, let's wait and see. But this one really looks like it's a terrestrial contamination signal, not an actual signal from extraterrestrials. There's all sorts of things, satellites, military, sending codes, sending signals that we could think is coming from beyond our planet, and that isn't. So those always have to be checked out first.
The strange thing about this situation is the Russians who announced it actually made this quote-unquote discovery a year ago. I mean, wouldn't it be incumbent, if you want this to be verified, to get the word out immediately and have everybody train their ears
on it? This is weird and fishy to begin with. So
okay.
It's a wait-and-see thing.
All right, back to the phones we go at 800-348-2551. Jim in Albany. Jim, you're on.
Yes, just as an aside to one of your other questions, I believe I saw the curvature of the Earth in it. 25-yard pool. I was the only one in there, and I had my back of my head against the gutter at one end and sunk down really slow. The water was glass smooth, and I noticed I couldn't see the lip of the gutter at the other end until I raised my head up. You believe you can see it that close, the distance away?
Okay, now 25 feet. You know, I did the calculations to figure out what...
25 yards.
25 yards. You know, maybe. I worked out the thing for a lake that was a few miles across. And the math showed me that, yes, what I was actually seeing by sinking your head down and putting your eye only a few inches above the surface, absolutely, surface would be hidden by the curve. But 25...
My nose is underwater.
Hopefully not for long.
Yeah, you know, I don't know whether that would be only a few millimeters distance.
I have another question.
All right.
The last week or two, I noticed in the southern sky an hour or two after sunset, there were three stars in a row.
You just tuned in, didn't you? We caught you. You just turned on the radio. You just started listening to the show, didn't
you? You don't have to castigate him for that. You know, people have busy lives. Anyway, Jim, Bob talked about this. That's okay, Jim.
The star at the bottom was moving towards the west day by day. You already talked about this one?
Now, the reason the star on the bottom looks like it's moving to the west is because the star on the left is moving to the east. So it may be looking by comparison that the star on the right, that is Antares, is moving the other way westward. In truth, the star on the left part of the triangle, which is the planet Mars, is moving
eastward. Oh, this isn't a triangle. These were three stars right in a row. And I've never seen that a direct line.
Yes, quite right. Those three, which are now a triangle, look tonight because we're going to get a clear night tonight and especially tomorrow night, after. Take a look and you'll see it's now a triangle and it's going to stay so for the next week. Okay. But you're absolutely right. Last week they formed a more or less straight line.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I missed the first part of the show.
That's good. Sure,
all right.
Thanks a lot. You see, you don't have to yell at the
callers. I shouldn't yell at
callers.
People.
No.
Okay, I'm
sorry.
Don't
if they say Vega wrong and it's Vega,
You're right.
Just mellow out now, all right? Let's go back to the phones again and let's hope nothing ugly happens. Rick in Great Barrington. Rick, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon. Really enjoying the show.
Oh, thanks.
My question is the graviton. If gravity is, if I jump off a porch on the ground, gravity pulls me down. If I'm a planet, the bending of space because of the sun, the planet follows that path around the sun, even though it's falling. What is the graviton's part in what is the graviton? And also, I've got a 16-inch reflector telescope, and I bring it out in public whenever I can. I love showing people. And Saturn's just beautiful through a telescope. Hmm. And that's my question. Thanks.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you
want to hang on the line or you want to hang up?
I'll hang out if you want. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Great about the big telescope in Saturn, and isn't that great? And again, for people who were tuning in late, that topmost star in the triangle, that is, if just look toward the south, first half hour after nightfall, triangle in the south, the topmost star is Saturn. If you've got a telescope, point it there. You won't be sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, now, through the telescope, we can also see Titan, the moon.
Yes.
Oh, great.
That's right.
Yeah, fantastic. But people just love looking. I mean, a lot of people have never looked through a telescope, and the first time they see Saturn or even the moon, you just hear them going, just, oh my God, how beautiful. And it's just a wonderful thing. I love doing it.
I'm going to try to find the moon before I try to find Saturn.
You're right. And by the way, you just said that people say, oh my God, and I just mentioned to somebody that in my, I guess it's 35 years of running an observatory, showing Saturn to people, people always say one of two things. At least most people say one of two things. They
Careful.
Either say, oh my God, or that's not real.
Okay, okay.
You know,
I thought
exactly
you were going
right.
somewhere else with that.
Two things they always say. Yeah, it's just, people are amazed. I mean, it's just, when you see it through a telescope, it's not like you're looking at a picture in a magazine. It's like, this thing is real.
Quite so. And you know, it's not scientific to say so, but the photograph, even though a photograph, especially through Hubble or from Cassini, is a lot sharper and clearer than what you're going to see through your telescope, yet the telescope view, there is something about the realism, the vibe, the presence, something about that knocks everyone backwards, whereas looking at a photograph does not do it. There's something about really getting the essence of the planet. It sounds very Woodstocky to say the vibe of the planet, but it's really true. It's quite astonishing.
So how far, if you wanted to emulate binoculars, how far would the two telescopes have to be apart to get a stereoscopic view?
No, you couldn't get a stereo view. The only thing is...
Miles apart? I mean, how could you do it?
Well, Saturn is 9.5 times the Earth-Sun distance. It's so far away that you could have a telescope miles apart, you're still not getting...
So if you put another telescope on the moon?
No, but here's the thing. We use at our observatory, and many astronomers use binocular eyepieces. That is two eyepieces that are hooked up to the same telescope. Each eyepiece is showing the same thing, and yet everybody feels as if they're getting a 3D view, and you know what? They are. You know why? Because there is no parallax for a distant object. So when you're looking at Saturn, even if it's the identical view through each eye, it'll give the eye the impression that you're seeing a 3D view of something
indeed.
Distant, and
like
it'll
it.
Still look true 3D.
Ah, we've never talked about that before. Let's go to Aaron.
But we didn't answer him about gravitons.
Oh, well, go ahead. Aaron and Rensselaer, you just hang on. You're talking about zero-point energy. We're going to talk about gravitons for a moment.
Yeah, just for a second.
Yeah, not a problem.
All right.
And the idea is that we still don't know what gravity is. Of the four fundamental forces, gravity is the only one that really defies explanation. True, Newton thought it was some invisible force that depends on the mass of objects and varies inversely with the square of distance. True, Einstein said no, a better way of thinking of it is the distortion of space-time caused by massive objects. But these are only descriptions of how things act. It still doesn't explain what gravity really is at heart. And so gravitons was an idea, again, of Einstein, that everything needs mediation. Every force requires mediation by some particle. For example, light seems to be the force-carrying particle for the electromagnetic force. In other words, a photon carries the electromagnetic force from one place and delivers it to another. When you get hit with a bit of light, that's delivering that force from a distant empire, even if it's a distant galaxy, to you, and then that force then acts on you. So it was thought that gravity, too, must have a force-carrying particle. And it's postulated that these are gravitons. So far, they have not been detected, but that doesn't mean that they don't exist.
All right, and then before, Aaron, I let you go here and ask your question, I ask Bob a question I've asked before, and that how is it that you scientific types can state with such certitude the likelihood of dark matter when you don't even know what gravity is and how it works?
That's a great question, because an alternative to dark matter is that gravity falls off differently than just inversely with the square of distance at weak levels. Now, in great distances between galaxies where gravity is very, very, very weak, maybe it doesn't continue falling off at the same rate, but falls off at a slower rate. And if it does that, then dark matter need not exist. We can explain everything we see just by gravity itself being weird.
All right. Now, Aaron, you've been waiting a couple of minutes here on the air, and now it's your turn. Go ahead.
That's okay. Ray, Professor Berman, thanks for taking my call. Sure. Good afternoon. Great show so far.
An ambassador.
My question is, I hear in science fiction at least three different times about something called zero-point energy. Basically, a power source out of nothing is the impression I get. I'm not 100% sure if it's a real thing or not. And if it is, how does it work?
Okay. Zero-point energy is another name for vacuum energy, and the idea that nothingness actually has a repulsive power to it. And this seems to be true. It seems there's evidence for it. In 1949, Casimir, I've forgotten his first name, discovered that if you put two metal plates, hang them very close together, they get pushed together violently by some unknown force on the outside of them. And so this seems to be evidence for the emptiness of space having a force. It would also explain why helium has no natural solid state. No matter how cold you make normal helium, it never turns solid. It remains liquid.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so these are evidences for vacuum energy or zero point energy. The problem is that theoretically, the amount of power it should have, and some predict that an empty mayonnaise jar of empty space should have enough Z point energy or vacuum energy to be able to boil away the Pacific Ocean in a second and a half. Now, that's an awful lot of power.
It's good mayonnaise.
But what little evidence we have shows that it may be 100 orders of magnitude different from that degree. And so observations versus theory is so different that it's currently called the vacuum catastrophe, because our knowledge of it is so rudimentary. Hmm. And that's where we stand.
Well, Aaron, thank you for that. We appreciate it. Let's go quickly over to Richard in Queensbury. Richard, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering about the solar eclipse next year. Is anybody planning on making one of those giant screen movies of the solar eclipse?
I could.
Let's let Chuck do this.
Okay. The Chuck wagon, as you call him?
The Chuck wagon.
Chuckster. Go ahead.
Okay, there's actually a couple projects being planned next year, which I'm part of. One is called the Citizen Kate Experiment. That's based out of Southern Illinois University. And there's another one called the Eclipse Mega Movie, which is a friend of mine is also doing that. And what it does is they're going to take common technology that kids can use, like cell phones, video equipment, and string together a 90-minute continuum of the solar activity from the coast of Oregon, how it appears at sunrise over the Pacific, and Oregon all the way to Charleston, South Carolina, where the shadow last touches the continental U.S. And there's going to be a big push for this for education, which I'm part of. We're going to be introducing this project to teachers probably in November, December, giving them time to prepare for it, getting the kids used to the order of sequence of operations and what we're expecting. So I could send you information. If you leave me your email address, I'll be happy to send you information.
Well, why don't we give your email? Do you have a contact information?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do that over the air.
It's SAROS, Saros, that's an eclipse term, 61@gmail.com. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
One more time on that email address.
S like Sam, AROS, again with the S, 61@gmail.com.
Okay. Very good.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks.
We appreciate it. So this is a big deal. The eclipse is when?
Monday, August 21st of next year.
And I have to go to Southern Illinois.
Well, you don't have to. You can go to.
I don't want to go to Southern Illinois.
You could be
Illinois.
Clouded out on the coast of Oregon if you prefer, or have thunderstorms in South Carolina.
Well, here is my problem. You drive to Southern Illinois, and then it's cloudy in Southern Illinois.
No, you check the weather. This is what you do. You check the weather, the forecasts, and you head in the direction that it's most likely to be clear. And then the kids will never forget it all their lives. This is the greatest thing. Your life will be divided into before you saw your first total eclipse and after.
Have you ever driven in a car with five kids?
No.
To Southern Illinois, for God's sake.
Well, you could go to clearer places like Wyoming. Like, I know someone's going there.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that'll be a good spot to go.
But the trick is to get the superintendents and principals to realize that these kids have to get outdoors and see it. So that's what I've been doing. I've been to 9 of the 12 states in totality.
So you handed me at the beginning of this show, and I got to believe these are some sort of gag. It says eclipse shades. They're like the 3D shades you go to the movies with.
You could see through clothes with them, actually.
Oh, really? Oh, the X-ray specs. Oh, I had those.
And by the way, you don't need those for the total part
no,
of the eclipse. You just
not.
Look at it directly. You could even use binoculars safely on the sun when it's total.
Really,
but that's for the partial. For an hour before the eclipse is total,
absolutely,
it'll be partial, and then for an hour after.
I call these partial solar eclipse glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can actually use these to look at the sun?
Yes, any clear day.
Okay, now if I let my kids try this and they go blind, I'm coming after the ambassador, okay?
Well, I live in a really remote area of the Berkshire, so you won't find me.
All right, fair enough. All right, Bob Berman, what's coming on for you? Anything coming up?
Well, yeah, sure.
Sorry to throw you that curveball.
No, we're actually, next year is a big year because we're taking groups to Chile and to the Northern Lights and to, of course, the total eclipse. A lot of things happening for next year. Our our tours for this year are finished.
Okay.
And other than that, there's the book, subtitle of that book. That's, you know, I hate that it's beyond biocentrism, because what does that really mean? That caller was very kind to mention it, but the subtitle tells what the book is about, if I may mention.
Go ahead. Do it right now.
Which is Rethinking Space, Time, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death.
Well, Bob Berman, you know, always fun to have you here. And Ambassador Fulco, nice to have you here as well. We're coming to the conclusion of another program, don't you know? Support comes from Ashokan Center, building community through shared experiences in nature, history, and the arts. The Ashokan Center in the Catskill Mountains, where nature inspires. AshokanCenter.org. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials. Rhinebeck, New Paltz, now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, featuring We Plan, You Plant, garden design service with on-site selection of nursery stock, plus tree, shrub, and perennial garden installation, whitneysfarm.com. And the Discovery Center, presenting September science programs featuring exploration into the worlds of birds, insects, and archaeology of the early Hudson Mohawk Railroad, albanypinebush.org. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Charles Fulco for being here. Thanks to you for listening and for all the great calls and emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who engineered this program, more or less. Thanks to Deb Malik, who answered the phones. Our producer, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Today's Thursday already. Wow! Tomorrow is a Food Friday, and it'll probably be about salt and pepper or something. Well, we'll find out. The news is next.